Last week on John Oliver, they had a collection of clips that have not aged well in the past year. So they had older clips from Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose, Harvey Weinstein, and Bill Cosby that, in hindsight, could be read less than charitably. Or they could have just been figures of speech. But things do change with time, and our perception of what may have been tolerable is no longer tolerable. That's a piece of historical advance. And I want to talk today about the issue of women's rights as human rights and the way in which our Torah falls short and the ways in which our tradition strives forward. So one of the most glaring issues in our Torah is the way it frequently reduces women's voices, women's personas, women's parts to silence and reduces them to offstage events, so to speak. So a couple of examples are that Rebecca has a nursemaid named Deborah, of whom we are never introduced, and we only hear of her that she dies in this week's parasha, I think just before our very first reading. And as I was reading today, I thought that might have been a connection to Rachel's dangerous childbirth. Because Rachel was her nursemaid, I misspoke. Because she was no longer with the person whom she had traveled, who had helped her perhaps in previous childbirth. And Rachel herself is given the sobriquet, the definition of her name, that is both kind and a bit dismissive. Rachel has the connotation of a ewe lamb, something cute and simple. Now we know her also as a shepherdess, which is among, as I think I said last week, among the highest professions one can have in the Torah and in our tradition. One of the most prestigious acts a person can do is to be a shepherd or a goat herd or a shepherdess. And it was, coincidentally at the time, a profession, we believe, that men and women entered in not equal numbers, but with equal ability. But also of Rachel, Rachel, we know very little, and we just know that she dies in labor giving birth to a son, that is her last great act, is to produce a male heir. These are all things we struggle with, that women, frankly, not just in Torah, but probably as late as the 1980s in literature, get reduced to marginal parts. As a New Yorker columnist once pointed out, when you look at fiction, for example, like modern Madame Bovary, the smaller characters that get a few lines, we don't worry about them much because they have no life outside the page. Whereas when you look at documentary, for example, Harlan County, you'll see in documentary figures that only appear for a few frames, but they had full lives outside of the documentary. So the struggle in our tradition is both that there are inevitably secondary characters, and as we can debate the historical accuracy or factuality of those characters, we do know that secondary and tertiary characters, in some perspective, had a broader life. That Rachel and Deborah, her nursemaid, have more grace and fluidity and fullness than we're given in our Torah. And that reduction of women's roles to secondary roles and excluding them from the main scene, putting them in background, is seen nowhere more clearly, I think, than in the story of Dinah, who was assaulted by Shechem, who was the prince of Hamor. And he assaults her and then claims her as his wife. He falls in love with her after violence, which is deeply problematic. And our tradition compares this to the assault that Amnon had on Tamar in the book of Samuel, and said that this is, to quote a Missouri Senate candidate, the legitimate kind, because he falls in love with her afterward. After Amnon has assaults Tamar, he discards her. There's no mention, either in Torah or later traditions, of what Dinah might have wanted until Diamant's book, The Red Tent. And I think that's probably the first mention in all of our midrashim, and we can understand that to be midrash, of Dina having agency. Not only do women frequently in tradition and elsewhere lack agency, they are, as I mentioned, somewhat excluded or put in a box or put in a blank space or a dark space of the scene. Explicitly in Midrash, this happens. So the parasha opens with Jacob carrying his properties and possessions and family across the river and secluding some of them from the predations of Esav. The fear he has that his brother will exact vengeance at this moment, so he guards his family carefully. But in the accounting of his family crossing the river, Dina is not accounted for. So here's the very painful midrash. Where was Dina? In a chest. He put her among his chattels to keep her away from the predations of her uncle. That's, frankly, the world we live in, to some degree. Now, the image of Matt Lauer locking his office comes to mind. But there's got to be a better way. And here's where I keep coming back when I struggle with our tradition and its deficits, of which there surely are many, and I would be loath to whitewash those deficits and the problematics of our tradition. But I like to believe, my hope and my faith is, that our tradition, to quote Martin Luther King, as I have, bends the arc of history towards justice. That it could not, as Maimonides noticed this, that it could not exclude sacrifices, because sacrifices seem archaic and atavistic to Maimonides. And his argument is you couldn't exclude sacrifices, at least you could exclude some of the sacrifices, human sacrifice, but people weren't ready to make the leap to a system without sacrifice, a system solely of prayer, study, and the written word as an experience of God. And I'd like to think, and we could debate this, I'm sure, that at the stages of our tradition, not always evenly, our tradition is forcing and bending the arc of history towards a more just resolution. So here's a few places I want to think about that together. So we're back in the very early verses of our parasha where Jacob wrestles the apparition, perhaps a man, perhaps an angel, who grants him gifts and tears his hip socket. And they're grappling, and the Talmud puts these words in the angel's mouth. Actually, this is what the angel says, the apparition. Let me go, for the day is breaking. And the Talmud puts these words in Jacob's mouth. Are you a thief or a rogue that you're afraid of the morning? Meaning, you know, criminals do their business at dark. Are you a criminal and need to get away before the police show up or there's good light to see you breaking in? And the apparition says, I'm an angel. And from the day I was created, my time to sing praises has not come until now. Which, a little background, angels, we understand, largely have a single duty in life. And for some genres of angels, some species, so to speak, they have one task. They wait their whole creation to accomplish the task, and then they evanesce. They disappear into the ether. So ideally, or one might imagine, that this angel's task was to wrestle with Jacob, to grapple with Jacob, to give Jacob blessing, to sing God's praise, and go. Which suggests to me that we have a task ahead of us. That both men and women, as I've suggested, need to not be silent. That in the face of a world that diminishes women's potential and agency and rights and voices, and granted, Brian read from the Torah today. Many of our worship leaders were women today. They will be on a regular basis. This is not an acute problem in the modern liberal Jewish movements, nor is it as acute a problem in our American political system as it might be in Uganda or Burma. But it does exist worldwide to some degree in every place. And we should be vocal in trying to change that. After all, I truly believe, and I can prove it to you in some degree, that women's rights are human rights. And I'll prove it by this. Well, maybe not prove, but demonstrate it through this logical statement that in the past roughly 20 years, rather than make direct money transfers to men in the developing world, development agencies have learned to make transfers to women in family units. Why? Because women are, do you know this? Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. I mean, it's a more insulting to men way of putting it, but the data is that women are much less likely to gamble, use the money on, for example, extramarital affairs or alcohol. I don't want to create an anti-sexism where we imply that all men are irresponsible, but it must be partly true. So really, I want to come back to that idea. I think women's rights are human rights, and they are demonstrated most effectively in that recent change of, for example, USAID and World Bank development and investment. And it is incumbent upon all of us, men, women, male, female, to address this inequity. So there's a scene where Jacob comes in from the field and he learns what happened to Dina, that she's been assaulted. And he remains silent, which is exactly what I'm telling you not to do. But here's the piece that the Ramban, Nachmanides, writing in Spain in the 13th century, said. He realized that nothing could be accomplished through the ordinary channels of justice, and to apply force, that is, to make things work out, he would need the help of his sons. Now, what Ramban, Nachmanides, is talking about, and probably the Torah is as well, is sort of internecine, intertribal assault. But I think implied in that is a sense that when there is injustice, it is incumbent upon us to find alternatives and workarounds to make justice, to force the arc of history into a just place, as Jacob saw when Jacob returned from the field. That in a place, to quote Pirkei Avot, where there is no human, strive to be a decent human. That we must do our best, be loud, be vigorous, be vibrant and even aggressive in pursuit of justice for all, male and female. And I wouldn't say inordinately, but at some level, this requires male allies. This requires that the men in this room and beyond stand up for their coworkers, for their spouses, for their daughters, for people they work with, for people they play with. All of us. Because, as I've noted, we live in a world where men's voices are still heard more easily than women's voices. Miriam has pointed this out to me when I've talked over her, to my discredit. So here's a beautiful scene. So Shimon and Levi, the eldest sons, take up arms for Dina. And they're later discredited for it because they give Jacob's family a bad name. But we're told that Shimon and Levi were Dina's brothers, and they acted vetach. They acted without consequence when they entered the city to slaughter the city. But that word betach means surety, guarantee, implying, at least in a time where there was such inequality and inequity of rights and powers and economic ability, that they were required to be the guarantors for the women. Which is not to say that the same case obtains now, but it is to say that we are all responsible, ze la ze, one for each other. And we all stand up for our fellow co-workers, women for women, men for women, women for men. We all have to defend each other for equity in the workplace, equity on the street, equity in the voting booth, equity country to country. Those are all real issues. And Simon and Levi are called in that sentence Dina's brothers, which is very odd because Dina has lots of brothers. Many, depending on how many you're counting, whether it's from the same mother or not, it's quite a few brothers. So why only these two? So our earliest midrash, one of the earliest midrash, the Mechilta, says, why wasn't she called the sister of all? Because she is called by their name or with their name because they risked their lives for her sake. Get up and do it. You know, there are a lot of ways to risk your lives in small ways that aren't that dangerous. Sometimes you've got to call a spade. Sometimes you've got to call someone out. Sometimes you've got to tell someone what they're doing is wrong and they can change. Sometimes sexism or abuse is unintentional and inadvertent, and we can do a lot of good just by standing up quietly and quickly and standing with the right person and not assuming that someone who is a witness in a crime or someone who herself was a victim to a crime, a survivor of a crime, has some agenda, that we can listen to their voices and assume the best. I think that's what Simon and Levi do. I think they hear their sister before they hear any of the opposing voices, and they take her side unconditionally. And lest you walk away thinking I've made a sermon about feminism that is only for men, and that our tradition's sole advice and sole voice in protecting women is that men need to stand up stronger, there are counter strands. There are many beliefs in our tradition that the women played roles that men were not capable of. So there are two. Since I started by talking about Rachel and Devorah, I want to end by talking about them, things that the Midrash, mostly medieval, said about them. So was anyone at Carol Harris's unveiling yesterday? So I read a poem by the Israeli poet Dalia Ravikovich, who talks about Rachel's death and the beauty of the simplicity of her death. That is something to be admired. So Rachel is buried at Roadside. She's not buried in the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs. She's buried at Roadside near what is now Bethlehem. And she is buried without eulogy, without marker. So Midrash asks why, and this leads to one of my all-time favorite Midrashim. It's the keystone of one of the great Midrashim of the destruction of the temple. Jacob foresaw that the exiles from Jerusalem would pass that way. That is, when the Babylonians conquered and razed Jerusalem for the first time, that they would leave by that route to go to what is now Iraq. Therefore, he buried her there such that she would hear the people's pleas and pray for mercy on them that the exile might end. Rachel in Midrash is precisely given a greater voice than she gets in Scripture. And maybe, given that Midrash is some centuries later, maybe the rabbis saw the need to bend the arc of history towards justice, to recompense Rachel with her voice, to give it back. Maybe. Jeremiah starts that process. That our matriarchs are not one-note characters, one-dimensional characters, one-sentence characters, but that they have, as that New Yorker author would notice, a life of their own. A full and flourishing life that we might have been unaware of, but that surely existed. And then the Dat Zekenim, the Tosafot, the descendants of Rashi, have this to say about Rebecca's nursemaid, Devorah, Deborah. Again, of whom we know almost nothing. She doesn't even appear at the opening of the Parsha. Suddenly she's there towards the last third of the Parsha, only to die. Which may be that there were alternate stories about her and there was deeper mythos about her that was never captured in Scripture. We have that, I just noticed it today, about someone who found a hot spring. If you look, it's towards the end of our readings today, and in the footnotes it said there must have been stories about these hot springs that were no longer captured. So maybe there were stories about Devorah, the nursemaid, that we don't know of. But the Dat Zekenim, the Tosafot, the descendants of Rashi in the 13th century, say this. The reason we're told about this at this point may be on account of her namesake, the prophetess Deborah, who appears in the book of Judges, who sat and held court near this tree by the grave of the nursemaid Deborah. A picture like the Bodhi tree that the Buddha sat under. That this tree, that this virtually unnamed, untold, unsanctified, unacknowledged woman, Deborah, died beneath, would flourish in later generations into women's leadership and women's full participation in Jewish life. Now, unfortunately, Deborah, the prophetess, the judge, the chieftain, was only a blip, but it was a model. It was a model for Rashi to teach his daughters how to put on tefillin. It was a model for Ms. Priesand to become the first bat mitzvah. She was the first rabbi. And for Kaplan's daughter to become the first bat mitzvah. It was a model for the female rabbis that exist now. It was a model for women to run for president. Maybe. Maybe that's what the Torah and our tradition is trying to say, that every generation bends the arc of history towards justice, and every generation recognizes more and more clearly that women's rights are human rights.